Welcome to Thinking Out Loud, the podcast that puts you inside conversations with the most deeply passionate, intensely dedicated, and yes, the most thoughtful people in our industry. So sit back and stay tuned. They may just change the way you think.
Hello, I'm Vicki Lins, President and CEO of CTAM, a marketing organization focused on media, entertainment, and technology. Today, I'm speaking with John Hendricks, founder and chairman of CuriosityStream. Of course, you may also know John as the founder and former chairman of Discovery Communications, the global media parent of Discovery Channel, Animal Planet, TLC, Science, and many other TV networks, ancillary businesses, and brands. John, I'd like to go back before we look forward. You launched Discovery in 1985. What did television look like then, and what was your vision for launching Discovery?
Thank you, Vicki, and it's great to be here. Yeah, this takes me back actually to a little bit before 1985 to 1975, when I, like a lot of people, learned about a new service that was going on satellite called Home Box Office in 1975. And it seemed like such a simple concept, a movie channel, but it was so profound in terms of its effect on the marketplace and for cable subscribers nationwide who began to get home box office. And it gave people a little more control over viewing. And so just as a consumer, I was thinking, when are they going to create my favorite type of service? And I was a longtime fan of factual television, and nobody did. Ted Turner launched CNN, and so we had a news channel in 1980. A year prior to that, ESPN had launched. And so I started thinking about a cable channel as early as 82. So in 1982 is when I actually incorporated in Maryland. And so the television landscape at that time was so radically different than today. 90% of viewing was still going to three organizations, ABC, CBS, and NBC, as well as some smaller outlets, but which were very important, PBS, and there were a lot of independent stations. But so broadcast television as a whole was enjoying a 90% share of America's viewing. But cable had started to make inroads with this 10%. You know, a lot of viewing was going in 1982 to HBO, some of the other movie services, as well as CNN, which was becoming a phenomenon. And so that was going to dramatically change over the course of the 80s, so that by the early 90s, it started becoming clear that the majority of viewing each night, each day, would transition toward cable television. And there was that magic moment, I remember, when cable viewing was at 51%. And it caused a lot of people to take note. And advertisers started to shift their spending to kind of match the viewing that was migrating toward cable.
So there was a lot of change, but over several decades.
That's correct.
Now what we're seeing is a lot of change in the course of months, really. The industry keeps reinventing itself very quickly, and the amount of disruption that's coming in is profound.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right. And it seems to me what we've witnessed is, and what we're witnessing, is kind of the third revolution of television. So television started with that first broadcast by NBC way back in 1939, and most observers felt that this was going to be a profound change. It's amazing to me, it's almost like clockwork, from 10 to 12 years after the introduction of some revolutionary way to enjoy television content, there's a frenzy. Almost everybody then realizes it. So in the early 50s, television just became omnipresent in American culture. And likewise, it was phenomenal. You know, HBO went on satellite in 75, and there was a real frenzy about 1985 to 1987. A lot of cable channels launched. People knew this was where viewers were going to migrate because it gave them more choice. And likewise, if you look back to the critical year of this third revolution, was 2007. And that's when Netflix, which prior to 2007 had distributed movies only on CDs, and they had transitioned to a streaming service. So that was 2007, and proved the technology. Apple TV was introduced that year as a way for you to enjoy content on your big screen that you were starting to enjoy on your computer. And so that was 2007. So you look, again, 10, 12 years later, we're in this frenzy now. everybody knows this is the next great migration of viewers. And it really is profound. It's unstoppable. If you think of it, linear television is analogous in many ways to the pay telephone booth. And because you have to meet, yes, I know, with a pay telephone booth, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, to make that phone call, we were traveling, you had to meet that location of where that phone booth was to make your call. And with linear television, we have to meet a program schedule. And so we have to watch that show, and we have to watch when it was programmed by a linear network. And of course, years ago, this was probably back 30 years ago, I heard there was a cellular telephone conference in Washington, D.C., and one of the panelists remarked, someday, you're not going to believe this, but you'll be in your home, you'll probably be within 10 or 15 feet of your land-based line, but you'll be making phone calls on your cellular telephone. And people, you know, just couldn't believe it. And so, but the convenience of a cell phone, making a call wherever you are, was such a consumer gift that there was no way to stop it, and it has swept the planet. And that's what we're seeing now with finally the end stage of television, I think of it, is on demand, where you can watch anything you want on demand wherever you are. And so you can't stop that migration from linear, where you have to meet a program schedule, to watching just exactly what you want to watch if you tune in at 8:17 at night. For example, at CuriosityStream, we have 2,100 choices at every second of the day.
2,100 choices.
And again, if you're a subscriber to Netflix, you have some 4,200 movies that you can watch any time, day or night. So that progression and that migration of viewers from linear to on-demand, again, is as unstoppable as the migration of viewers or telephone users from payphone booths to cell phone booths. It really is unstoppable. So this is the third revolution of television.
So there are two important questions in there I really want to ask you. The first is the current content distribution model. How long before it's gone?
Well, there's enormous stresses now on the way content has been distributed. So you have, you know, you'll continue to have over-the-air broadcasting, and people are rediscovering digital transmission, and they can get I'm constantly amused at millennials realize that they can get an antenna and actually pick up digital transmissions of ABC, CBS, and NBC. So that will continue, and largely for, I think, live event programming, certainly for sports, live news, and live competition shows like The Voice or American Idol, I think will largely stay on linear broadcast television. Then the real stress is happening, of course, on the cable systems, where they're paying significant license fees for a lot of cable networks that people are no longer watching. And so that's unsustainable. I'm convinced that over the next decade, what we'll see is a steady erosion and replacement of linear channels with just on-demand menus. And it'll start with the large cable operators that will change out channels and give people just the wealth of choice that a Netflix, a Hulu, a CuriosityStream, and other services yet to debut present for the consumer. Because it's the way we want to consume television.
So that then begs the second question that was in there, which is about the programming side of the business. Not only will networks need to change their business model because those affiliate agreements aren't going to be the crux of their revenue stream, at least in the existing model, but also programming to time and audience for the linear model no longer makes sense. Now you're really programming for what people like and want.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So how does that then shift not just the business model on the programming side, but also the content around what the programmers are focusing on?
So if you look at the programmers, the traditional cable programmers, and I started a lot of cable networks, and you know the company I started all the others who are operating in that model, the stress is that most cable operators would love to offer their services on an a la carte basis. They would love to offer ESPN, for example, on an a la carte basis, so only those people who love sports programming, and there's about 20% of America that does, would pay and subsidize through a license fee, ESPN. But that's also the case for all the other cable channels. But they're kind of trapped in the linear model because most of the cable affiliate agreements provide the cable distributor, like a Cox or a Comcast, with the ability, if that network programmer provides a service to any other distributor or directly to the consumer on an a la carte basis, they would get that right. And then the economic model starts unraveling. It's very powerful in terms of selling advertising if you get that bulk distribution on cable so that you're in front of all 22 million Comcast video subscribers, you know, versus just a subset of those that might subscribe to a service on an a la carte basis. So again, that's the big stress in the system. You know, every 5 to 7 years and the agreements come up between, you know, a programmer and their cable affiliates. And, you know, we've seen some wars, you know, that have materialized. And I think that will just intensify over the next decade as industry struggles in this big movement to change from the delivery of linear channels to on-demand menus. Because the cable operators have to do that. That's what the consumers want to have. And so the cable distributors, satellite distributors will have to make that transition.
So there's a whole lot of upside for consumers in this. They're going to be able to get more of what they want. They're going to be able to get it when they want it. To some degree, they're going to get it on their terms because of this competitive landscape.
Yeah, I think you're right. And the industry will go through, I think, the next 3 to 5 years to find the right model of pricing for the consumer. What the consumer is losing, although they're getting some abundant choices. You know, there's a number of consumers who've tweeted when they get CuriosityStream and they have Hulu. I remember there's one tweet that one woman tweeted. She said, I have Netflix, Hulu, and CuriosityStream, and it's almost perfect. Well, it's not perfect because she can't see Game of Thrones. Okay, so that's an HBO service. So when you start trying to, as a consumer, get services that deliver all of the content you want, you might want the new offering from Disney that's going to be debuting this year, that's going to have the output from not only Disney Studios, but also the output of Fox. And so that'll be another cost that you'll have. So the consumer's losing some bundling benefits, but I think the industry over time will settle on some kind of a bundled approach to try to replicate some of the value, at least the economic value of cable. So cable's been an enormous economic value for the consumer. Just think, 500 channels of choices, you know, for maybe $90 to $120 a month. If you divided that per channel, that's a lot. But the problem is people aren't just, they're not watching those channels. You know, Nielsen has confirmed over time that even a consumer has 500 channel choices, they tend to watch 7 to 8 on a regular basis. And so for the future, the consumer is going to have a lot of choice, and I think the marketplace has to respond with pricing that keeps it affordable to the consumer.
Magid has come out with research that shows that the tipping point for consumers is about 6 services that they're willing to pay for outside of the cable bundle model. And so let's shift to CuriosityStream. Mm-hmm. Because ideally you'd like to be one of those 6 or 8 that people opt into. And to your point, when people try to aggregate independently on their own all of the things they'd like to see, the model doesn't yet work to their advantage because the Game of Thrones is always hanging out there, so there's always that one more service that they want to add, and at some point the cost of all of that doesn't make sense and they go back to their aggregated bundle.
That's right.
But that's shifting, and we've been talking about that. And so CuriosityStream is coming in at a time where consumer choice is becoming a bit more independent of the bundle.
Right.
Talk to us about what CuriosityStream is and what that model looks like in terms of being a driver for consumers to choose to subscribe.
Yeah, so our approach is to try to make it as affordable as possible. And so we're aware that the consumer may have, we look at it as a total budget that they may spend for their entertainment options, and that may be anywhere from $60 to $90. And so, again, they're going to need a high-speed data delivery service, so they need a broadband connection, so that's going to be a minimum of $30, maybe as high as $50. And then I think most people will want the broadcast network, so they'll find a solution. It might be a skinny bundle. It might be something where you can get some news channels plus local broadcast signals, and that might be anywhere from $15 to $25 a month. Okay, so now you've already spent some money. And so I think Netflix is going to be almost a must-have for most people. Hulu's a popular service. And so fairly quickly, you can see the bill starting to run over $60, maybe over $70. So that's why we want our service priced for the planet. And so the most economical way to get CuriosityStream is an annual subscription for only $19.99 a year. So the price we all used to pay for one DVD, you can get CuriosityStream and all 2,100 and growing titles all year long. And so we think it's a great value proposition. So at Discovery, and for most of us who've built basic cable networks, the economic model was trying to secure your place on the cable dial in a bundle in which you would get 40, 50, or 60 cents per sub per month, and look at what that spending at that wholesale level to the cable operator was able to produce. I mean, if you got 50 cents, you know, per sub, and that's $6 a year. And so just imagine 500 million global households, which is what some of the big services have achieved globally, like Discovery Channel. That's a huge revenue stream. That's $3 billion, which can be matched by advertising. So again, if CuriosityStream over time can just get, you know, 80 cents, a dollar, a dollar 20, that's more than enough for us to build a huge business, and it's very economical for the consumer. So we've tested pricing high. You know, we've had our service priced as high as $5.99 for HD service, and a lot of people took the service, so we know the value's there. But for millennials on a budget, we felt that was an unsustainable price, and so we've been testing with lower prices. We have some offers in the marketplace that even go below $1.99 to maybe a dollar a month, so we're testing. Again, our approach is price for the planet, be mindful of the consumer budget, and try to be one of those six services that they get in addition to their bundled linear channels.
You touched on something really interesting when you were referencing the desire you've seen for CuriosityStream, and that is that it appeals to a very broad spectrum of viewers. I think there might be a misconception that it's a niche service, when in fact it's quite broad-based.
Absolutely.
Across all types of genre of fact-based programming, which has always been a passion of yours. So speak to us a little bit about the content and the vision for the content of CuriosityStream.
Yeah, there's four, when you think about it and step back from it, there's four large categories of television content. There's movies and scripted, there's factual, there's sports, and then there's a kind of a big area, you can just call it general television entertainment, that covers everything from sitcoms to game shows to live broadcast of all types. And so, again, we're a full category player. Just like Netflix plays the full category of movies, they're not just a horror movie channel. So there's a lot of peril being a niche, and we've seen kind of the demise of movie services that have developed for all kind of niches, Korean movies, and there's been others, especially in the horror. Comcast launched a service called Chiller, and that was recently shut down. So you don't want to be a niche, I think, in the SVOD world. And so that's why we defined our service as the full factual menu for SVOD. So CuriosityStream covers all of factual, from science, history, nature, human adventure, global issues. We see ourselves developing a news magazine, for example, that's just perfect for the mobile platform, for example. And so again, it's all a factual television, which has always been there. I mean, we've all recalled from broadcast days, you know, the wonderful experiences we've had with great documentaries on PBS from Ken Burns, all the wonderful news magazines and news broadcasts from CBS, whether that's 60 Minutes or the evening news broadcast. So factual has been with us. And when it's done right, as when we partnered with the BBC at Discovery on Planet Earth, we saw an enormous audience that came out to watch over a period of time on several of our networks, you know, cumed well over a 40% share. When Planet Earth 2 debuted in the UK a couple of years ago, it was stunning, had a 41% share. So we know there's an enormous interest in factual programming. You know, I kind of think of the world being 40% full of curious people. And these are the people that really will show up to watch anything that's factual, that will give them some new knowledge or insight on the world, whether it be something that's happening in global issues, some interesting story in history, or some advance in technology or science. So it's a very dependable audience, and so we're pleased to program for them.
You're probably listening to this podcast because you're a smart, busy executive who wants to keep up with the latest news and trends efficiently. And you're probably also a CTAM Smart Brief subscriber. Did you say no? Then you're missing out on the finest industry news briefing, deftly delivered daily to your inbox. Like I said, it's smart, it's brief, it's always free, and read by thousands of leaders like you. Sign up today at smartbrief.com/CTAM.
Knowing we were going to be speaking today, I looked up the definition of curiosity, just out of curiosity. And the dictionary says it's a strong desire to know or learn something. And I thought that was such a wonderful reflection of the library of content that CuriosityStream offers, because it's really interesting that you have technology-focused programming along with adventure programming or nature programming, and they don't seem to have a common bond. But when you think of it through the filter of an audience who loves to learn and be exposed to new information and experiences, it makes sense. Yeah. I've seen it play out in my family, where my 87-year-old father was watching that type of programming with my 10-year-old son.
Exactly.
And they were both loving it as much as the other was. And so it's interesting to me that the CuriosityStream audience is really quite diverse. So I'm headed somewhere with this. You've announced a interesting approach to advertising and to integrating brands into your programming in a very non-disruptive way. But you've almost built categories around the buckets of programming that you offer, not only to fit it with the brands that make the most sense for it, but to deliver it to the audience in ways that might help curate their viewing experience through CuriosityStream. Is that accurate?
Yes. And the word curiosity is at the heart of, in many ways, the human experience. I mean, we are desperate to learn about our environment. And so CuriosityStream kind of speaks to not only understanding difficult topics in science and technology, but just understanding human experience, whether it's climbing a mountain and all that that entails. And we have programming in abundance on the human experience, in addition to all the kind of traditional learning areas. And what we've observed, too, is that, you know, over time, as advertisers have looked at television and where they want association with their brands, factual nonfiction programming stands at the top of their list. They love people who are curious, that are engaged in life. There are certain sponsors, as you can imagine, who sponsor programming on Sunday mornings that are interested in reaching people who are voters, who are interested in government affairs. And so all of that audience lives on CuriosityStream. So we thought, you know, how do we best develop a role for sponsors in a world where people want to watch commercials less and less? And so for us, the response was, let's not break our content with commercials, but let's give a certain number of sponsors. We don't want an ad cluttered environment, but a certain number of sponsors the opportunity to present programming and to present it through a 15-second pre-roll spot so that the viewer knows that a certain sponsor brought them the show. And in 15 seconds, we think the viewer will tolerate that, as long as you don't keep repeating the same spot over and over during a viewer session. And so we've been carefully studying this, and we've been pleased to have a number of sponsors who've been testing this with us, ranging from telecommunications provider like Sprint. We've also had Toyota testing with us as well to look at what is the right way to integrate sponsors in a non-cluttered environment that they'll embrace rather than be annoyed with. So Netflix launched without any commercials and without any advertising, and it spoiled a lot of people of having that commercial ad-free environment. Some services have launched in the SVOD space that are just chock full of commercials. And in response, they've had to create commercial-free versions. And so what we're trying to do is navigate a way where we can just have one service, but have it very mindful of how people like to consume television these days.
It's an interesting approach, because there is a whole lot of debate about ad-free versus ad-integrated, and it isn't necessarily an either-or proposition. There is a way to
That's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to find that middle ground.
And research keeps showing that consumers have an appetite for some advertising if it's appropriate to them and if it's not intrusive to their viewing experience.
Exactly. So what I want to do is unleash the great sponsorship support that enabled us at Discovery, for example, decades ago, to produce incredible content. I remember when Planet Earth was a very expensive production, but we were thrilled that Bank of America almost covered half of the production cost by a sponsorship. because they love that association. When we introduced the big natural history special Life, it was sponsored by Geico, which loved that association. So that's what I'm trying to do, is find a way where great corporate brands can be part of creating great content for television, but in a way that's not intrusive to the viewing experience.
So we're here at TCA, the Television Critics Association Tour. There's a ballroom filled with television entertainment journalists. Later today, CuriosityStream is presenting. What is the story that you hope those journalists will write about CuriosityStream?
Well, I think, you know, Clint Stinchcomb, who's our CEO, and I will talk a little bit about the industry, and we're going to field some questions about the SVOD space and how we see the on-demand world kind of evolving over the next 5 to 10 years and our role in that. And then we get to debut one of our great original programs or series. It's called Speed. I've been fascinated with humans' fascination with how we move as humans, you know, beginning...
Slower as we age.
Slower as we age, but faster through the eons of time, you know, beginning with walking carriages, sailboats, and just, you know, through trains and aircraft and through spacecraft. And so this is the epic story that we tell in four parts about how humans move as people. And it's a very elegant series. We're so proud of it. And we have the presenter and the documentarian who's here today to present that. So I hope they come away with, impressed by the array of content. We'll be showing them a highlight tape, which showcases our content across all the factual areas from science, technology, history, human adventure, and global issues, as well as lifestyle content. So we hope they'll be impressed with the full category of offering that we have that addresses the factual appetite of the viewers out there, as well as really be impressed with one of our over 800 original titles that we've produced. So I've been at this now, and our team's been at this now for a little over 4 years. We launched in 2015. And we're working on it a little bit in advance of that. And so I knew from the outset that part of our success would depend on original production. And original production can take 18 months or longer. And so it's so gratifying now to see the results of our labor over the last 3 to 4 years starting to hit the screen, as Speed will shortly on CuriosityStream.
What is the balance of original programming to other content on CuriosityStream?
So today it's about, I would say, around 40%. And so again, it's around 800 of 2,100 titles.
That's impressive.
It's very impressive.
Window,
and it's because we started some time ago and we knew. So we're a little bit ahead of the curve. And so right now you see a lot of services that are scrambling for content. And a lot of the rights have been fragmented. And so even Disney has to claw back rights from Netflix over, you know, when they launch their service. It's going to be interesting to see where the television content that's produced by Time Warner, Warner Media, which is now on Hulu, and also Comcast with the NBC content is now on Hulu. That's owned by a direct competitor now. That's controlled by Disney. Whether that content is clawed back to help build their services. And so in a world that's really kind of desperate for content that's been cleared globally, we kind of knew this was going to happen. And so we started to originally produce some 4 years ago. There's kind of five beautiful words when describing content, your content rights. It's worldwide, it's all media, in perpetuity. And that's what original programming does. So we have some 1,500 of our titles are cleared for China. And we're so proud of that. I mean, it's hard to imagine having a service with global ambitions without having rights to stream in China. So again, we've been pleased that we've been able to not only acquire rights to some of our licensed content for China, but again, everything that we produce, we own all rights worldwide in perpetuity.
The word visionary is often associated with your name, as is the word entrepreneur. And so here you are again, launching a not-so-new venture 4 years in, but another new venture with a vision towards the future landscape. In 10 years, what do you want CuriosityStream to look like? And how much change do you think will be around it? What's the landscape view of what it will be sitting in the middle of?
So I think we will be looking at an enormous, what all of us kind of speak the marketing language, is there's an enormous addressable market for on-demand programming. So if you look worldwide, there are some 4 growing to 5 billion users of the internet, which is a stunning number. But today, it's about 1 to 1.5 billion can actually stream video. But that's going to grow. That will be 2 to 3 billion. So if you look at a service like Netflix, it's penetrated 13% of the addressable marketplace with about 150 million subscribers. So even if they just stay at that level, there'll be over 400 or 500 million households when that addressable market's at 3 billion. So my hope is that CuriosityStream, through our bundled relationships with distributors, with our a la carte sales through the distributors, and then our direct-to-consumer offerings, that we can be a service some 10 years from now that's in hundreds of millions of households. So we want it to have the greatest effect possible globally. And I think by that time, we should be well over 5,000 titles and choices. And I expect that our original library will be not 40%, but 60%. Or even larger at that time. And I'm excited about the economics. When you unleash worldwide consumer spending for great content, then what you can produce, you know, with that revenue stream. So again, we're kind of in this not only to build a great business, but to have a positive impact on the world. And we think factual content, the more people know and understand, I think it's good for the world. And so again, we feel part of a great cause. We're looking to align with distributors who want to empower people through media. And so as I look over the next 10 years, I think there's great alliances that CuriosityStream will form with some of the giant distributors on the planet.
You mentioned marketing. I'd be remiss if I didn't go back to it just for a moment. How important is the network brand in this shifting landscape? How important is it for CuriosityStream to have a distinct meaning in the minds of consumers so they seek it out and want to?
Yeah, I think the brand is paramount because the brand connotes your promise to the consumer. And we want to have a very consistent promise that we will help satisfy your curiosity. And we think there's nothing more valuable than when a consumer interacts with one of our videos, and after 5 or 6 minutes of watching, they think to themselves, gee, I didn't know that. That's a very powerful bond and connection. And again, we want to consistently provide those kind of experiences. And so curiosity speaks to the heart of that promise. We're going to satisfy your curiosity. And so I worry a little bit about funny names that don't have a connection. They're memorable. Like Hulu is an interesting name, and it's very memorable, like Yahoo. But the brand name alone doesn't really speak to a specific brand promise. And so that's why when I started Discovery, I wanted a service that helped people to discover the world. But at the driving force beyond, you know, behind all of our exploration is curiosity. And so I felt this next service, this next factual service for the streaming era, I felt curiosity would be a great brand name that we need to nourish and enhance over the next decades.
Well, I'm pretty sure our listeners are filled with curiosity about what you're going to do next, where CuriosityStream is headed, and all of the wonderful things to come. And I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that although the journalists get you later, we got you first.
Absolutely, you
Thanks
did.
Thanks so much for being with us
today.
Well,
it's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Hope you found this Thinking Out Loud conversation interesting and perhaps even thought-provoking. There are more on the way. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave a review.